There are a lot of words used to describe how we fail to see what's in front of us. The image of through a glass darkly, the idea of veils, and the word I was looking for before was filters. We all misperceive life because we don't see it clearly. And in a sense, we are partly responsible for the filters. We unconsciously but actively begin to assemble these filters because, one, we're programmed to, and two, because in a way it's easier for, let me put it this way, an immature mind to see the world through a narrow focus, because the experience of totality requires a certain kind of maturity. And not everyone is ready for that. But because my life is so baby-centric, with an almost 9-month-old and a 3 and a 3/4-year-old baby in day-to-day life, I become very observant of how the filter begins to assemble itself, or the filters. And we're so unconscious of it that we don't even understand when we get older how little we're seeing. If you're a conscious parent or grandparent and you know that you are very much part of the process of establishing the filtering system, you try to do it consciously. You try to tell your child that they're loved, that they're worthy of love, that certain behaviors are not loved, but they don't affect the fact that you love them, that you distinguish between behavior and being, that you help, as a parent perhaps, contradict some of the social filters that are coming into play, and there are numerous social filters. They have to do with, you're a girl, you're a boy, you are meant to behave this way and not that way, that certain behaviors are disapproved of and you are seen as being unworthy, or you are seen as being a bad child. And you can identify with all these things. You might even identify with being bad. Some kids find, well, that's where all my attention is coming from, and I will be a bad person because the focus, the energy, the intensity of experience is so much greater than being a good child. You're told that you are beautiful, that you're cute, that you're sweet, whatever you are starting to build this identity block by block by block by block. Talia now walks around, she says, I have a sweet tooth, which means she therefore has a right to as much candy as she wants, because that's who she is. She can't help herself. Like her mother, she has a sweet tooth. She's, I don't know if I'd said this last week, this thing about Talia, but it kind of defines her. I was making her breakfast last week, and I said, I think I did tell this last week. Do you want to read a Time magazine while I'm making you breakfast? And she says, no, I only read The New Yorker. And that's so much who she is already. She has a sense of self, and she's picking and choosing and building this person. Everyone in this room has done that. Everyone in this room not only has built a person unconsciously and vaguely consciously since you were a child, but this person that you have constructed is something that you will defend to the death to support and to be. Some of you don't like that person. Some of you would like to get rid of parts of it. But mostly we are identified with the filter and the vision of who we are through that filter. And it's really the cause of all of our suffering. It's in many ways illusory. Illusory because it's only an imprint of a moment that you have extended into a very long-term perception. If someone tells you you're stupid when you're in the second grade, that imprints. You can walk around either being stupid or fighting that identity for the rest of your life. You don't want to be that person. You know, I remember summer camp, going to summer camp, which I didn't want to go to, and playing baseball, which I couldn't do, and getting a, four ball. I had a ball. I mean, I don't know the terms anymore, you know, but I never hit a ball. And I had a walk the first time at bat, and everybody just jeered me. It was like the worst thing that could have happened. I didn't even know why I was being jeered, but I knew two things. I will never play baseball again, and I cannot bear being perceived with a jeer. The idea that people don't like me for something I can't do and don't even understand. And I never played baseball after that, even when the opportunity might have been wonderful and fun and enjoyable. That was absolutely no. And I began to then generalize that into most sports because I could see that's not where my strengths are. So where were my strengths? Well, somehow I was creative, so therefore I could tell stories, which kids love. I could put on plays, which the neighborhood kids seemed to enjoy. And I started to build a structure that I called Bruce that I liked. You know, in many ways I liked. There were things I didn't like. The fact that I was such a bad athlete was always a pain for me because I couldn't be what other people would approve of. So I had to find other approvals and did. If someone tried to take that away from me, if someone diminished me, that was a terrifying thing because then who was I? Who was I without these strengths? And we all have them, and they're all relatively fragile structures. And all of us have these fragile structures that we do not want to be attacked by anybody, and we will attack anyone who tries to do battle with them. And it's very, very painful defending this, what I would call, assemblage of self. And the natural progression of life is to begin to disassemble that self. And many of us think of that as the most terrifying thing in the world. You look at something like Alzheimer's, where you can't remember who you were or are, and we see that's got to be the most terrible thing ever. But in fact, it may be actually quite a blessing. My mother-in-law, who I've talked about quite a bit, who had something approaching Alzheimer's, described with different terminology, but as she forgot who she was, she was a woman who absolutely had a kind of need for vengeance with so many people in her life who had done her wrong. And then she couldn't remember who they were or why they had done her wrong. And all that part of her psyche fell away. And there was suddenly this very sweet, almost childlike, innocent person. And she was such a good person in the end. She was not fun to be around in the middle. But in the end, she became very calm and very quiet and very at peace. And her last moment, which I've described in many other places, but I'll describe it again. She's lying in her hospital room on the last hours of her life, and I walk in the room, and there's tubes everywhere, and she looks at me, and she goes, that's all there is to say. What can you do? What can you do? Here I am. This is it. This is what it comes down to, this moment. And she was more at peace at this final letting go of her life than almost anybody I know who lives a very gregarious and intelligent and supported life, because the process, I don't understand the process, but the process is create a self, use it to build you and then also the world, because we're here in a way to do that, and then have it taken apart. And as it's taken apart, it either frees you or scares the hell out of you. But it's going to happen, and you can be a participant in that journey if you want. It's kind of paradise gained and paradise lost in a way, but really, it's the other way around. You kind of lose paradise as you create this self, and then you rediscover it again as you let go of the self. The self that you have created is, in a sense, of very limited duration and serves a very real function, which is you are in the material world because you need to be here to do something. The world needs you. I mean, look out the windows. All those houses have to be built. There's a university down there trying to teach you all about the history of the world and where it's come from and perhaps where it's going. You know, this world is an extraordinary construct, and we're all absolutely here temporarily to work it, to do it. And then our job is done, and the whole identity that came into the building is now being taken away, and you go, but, you know, that's who I am, that's what I am. And basically, if you get a teaching along the way that says it is not unnatural to let go of this stuff, you begin to participate in something that is referred to as liberation. You liberate yourself from your identity. And it is not easy. It's not easy because it's so terrifying to the ego structure that has built this brick by brick. It's now, it's either a solid hut or a huge mansion. You know, it may be a penthouse overlooking Central Park. You know, built this thing, how dare they take it away from you? But they do. They will. And they being, you know, Rudy used to call it the guys upstairs, which I love, but it is, who knows what it is, but it is the process. I've talked about it in recent time as Shiva. You know, the universe has, in Hindu terminology, has three gods, a god of creation, Brahma, Vishnu preserver, Shiva destroyer. Well, as you get to a certain point in life, Shiva becomes a dominating force. You know, the preservation part is over. And now we're having the part that takes you apart. It's not a bad guy. It's perceived by the ego mind as a villain. You know, the scariest thing in the world. But by the soul, it's simply a force that undoes you. And releases you back to what? What does it release you to? Well, for most people, what it releases you to is a complete unknown and therefore terrifying, as the unknown is often terrifying to people. But if you have begun a practice of meditation, of sitting still, of quietly practicing letting go, or as Rudy would call it, surrender, as you practice that, you start to sit in these spaces inside this chakra system. And you find your way, perhaps in my situation, into the heart chakra. Each one of us has a dominating chakra. But you go into the core of that chakra and you sit still there. Once you get past the terror of boredom, the terror of stillness, you discover, and you'll see I have a little sign downstairs that says, be still and know who I am, or know that I am. And in the Bible, I think it's be still and know that I am that. But just be still and know that I am. If you can find that practice in yourself, you start to go inside, and the part of you that is struggling to be something or someone quiets down for a period of time. And you just sit there and you go. You actually start to feel pretty great. It's surprising how good you feel without you there. The you that you let go of when you go into sleep at night. You know that feeling when you go, oh, it's all gone. And you go into this space. In a way, meditation is doing that wide awake. You go, oh, and you just sit there. And as I often describe, it's what I call the portal. And I guess you could have it, I don't do it so much through my mind, or through my ego superstructure. I do it in my heart. I go right here, get very still, and then the portal opens. And I am just floating in the absolute. And the thing about being in the absolute, or whatever you want to call it, cosmic consciousness, God consciousness, one, it's so familiar. Two, it's so embracing. It so loves you for being. It is, in a sense, love itself. And you just are there. And in a way, you know, not only have you gone to it, but it's never not been there. You know that, in a sense, it's the very place from which you emerged and the place back to which all of us return. So you start to develop a real familiarity with this place, and you start to go, I want to go there. Now, in opposition to that is the world. Oh, you know, money and wealth and sex and fame and all of this stuff. And it's so compelling. Or, you know, I'm the worst person who ever lived, which is a great way of being very locked in the world. Or I am whatever you think you are. I am, I am, I am, I am. It absolutely destroys your ability to get still and realize what I am is nothing. Nothing. There's nothing there. No person, no form, no content, no color, nothing. But it is the source of everything. And it is so exquisitely satisfying, welcoming, complete, total, absolute. And there you are. So, in this journey back to that, you have a heads up. Because you're not going to be suddenly shocked by it at the very end of your life. You are going to be someone who goes, of course, this is it. This is how it works. And you have this enormously beautiful process through your life. Not that you can't get caught. Every one of us gets caught by stuff. It's hard to get all those filters to go away. You're going to have some primary filters, often formed like when you were 4 years old, 5 years old. I got locked in a shed in the backyard of a house when I was 4 or 3. And my mother couldn't hear me calling. I couldn't reach the handle. And I developed a fear of, I guess, claustrophobia. I was stuck and I couldn't get out. As much as my mind knows that and tells me that it's nothing to worry about, put me in a claustrophobic space and all this four-year-old fear just comes surging up. And I can stare it in the face, and I do now, but it's absolutely there. It's resonated now for all of these years. It has power. And what I have to do, and what Buddha did sitting under the Bo tree, is like, okay. And you go to this place where you are freed of it. But you also realize it's fun to watch the little mind going, you're still there, you're still stuck, you're still in that place, you're not getting out of here. You know, even when you come out of this beautiful space, you're still going to be caught in whatever, the elevator or wherever you think you might be. I don't know if any of you guys have that, but I don't like elevators that get stuck. And so there is this thing that I have to work through. And the scary part is, unfortunately, whatever the worst version of all this is finally going to get you. Probably one version of it. Somehow or another, there is a biological inevitability to your not breathing, for example, or going through something that's very painful. None of us are going to avoid that. None of us. All of this preparation, it's like Lamaze class, you know? You practice and practice to have a child, and you've got all these things, you've got it all worked out, and then you're actually lying in the bed delivering a child, and all of it goes out the window. You know, you know, it's like, oh my God, this really hurts, you know? But at the same time, it brings you a certain kind of consciousness, a certain awareness of process, so that when it's taking place, you can actually, in a sense, say quietly yes to this thing, to this final inevitability. We're all heading down that road. There's a somewhere along the way, something tells you, if this thing is inevitable, why am I not paying attention to it? If this is the one ultimate truth, why am I looking at everything else but that? You know, it's a journey we're all on, and we're not paying attention. I'm not saying all of you, but there's a lot of religious indoctrination that tells you paying attention to this is urgent. And my experience with many people is there's no sense of urgency at all. They're too busy. I got to get this report to the office. I got to finish this. I got to call the bank. It's like the list of things keeps you so engaged that you don't have time to think about inevitabilities. And so you don't. And so religion, Sunday mornings or wherever, once Saturday mornings, they pull you back into, hey, this is a short ride. Something's going to end it, and you're not ready. And then they scare you to death with, you know, the hell thing, or they try to scare you with that you might miss out on heaven, and that starts to become something you just absolutely don't want to know about. It's just like, give me a break, you know. I'll get there when I get there, and of course you will get there. And you know, again, I keep repeating stories, but my grandfather was 103 and had finally arrived at a kind of peace in his life. His secret of life, he told me, is prunes. And so I will share that with you. Prunes, regular, keep you regular. And that was probably the greatest wisdom that he had to impart. And the day of his death, he's having heart failure. They rush him to the hospital. They said they could do extraordinary means to save him. He said, no, I'm fine. I'm at peace. And then 10 minutes later, he suddenly realized he was going to die. And he went, save me. He was so desperate for anything. And they said, Mr. Rubin, it's too late. There's nothing we can do. And he was horrified because he really wasn't at any point ready for what was coming. And neither are most of us. But this idea of sitting, this idea of opening to the eternal, this idea of finding your way into presence offers enormous advantage in terms of just day-to-day life. Because when you are aware of this presiding force within you, it has a kind of guiding principle. I call it, it's a little bit like the rudder in the water. A lot of people are rudderless. They're just going through life, as, you know, just wherever the waves take them. But this gives you, you just have this instinctive way of going where you're supposed to be going. It also gives you a sense of the infinite in the finite, so that you're always aware that the finite is composed of something so much greater. And that simple awareness and your ability to access that puts this in perspective. And to live with this in perspective gives you a sense of being part of the whole rather than being separate from everything, being a separate floundering little fish in a very big sea. You're not that. You are one with the ocean itself. You are, you know, the drop of water in the ocean, and there's no way to separate you from that oceanic being. And you are the thing you're searching for. And the incredible thing that happens in spiritual awakening is the entire filter system, the whole filtering, just goes, wah! It's like, it's kind of like being in the ophthalmologist, you know, office, and you're looking at the eye chart, and they're putting all these, you know, filters, things in, you know, number one or number two, which is clearer. It's like that whole thing just goes away and everything is clear. It's like, oh, it's clear. And then you just live in a kind of clarity. You live without all that stuff going on. And it's a shock to the system when that falls away because you're not prepared for that. As I've said 1,000 times already, the ego wants awakening and the ego wants enlightenment to make itself even a bigger presence than it already is. And so we're seeking it for our own self-aggrandizement. We want to be a spiritual being. We want to be a teacher or whatever it is you want to be, you know, capable, famous, you know, renowned for your wisdom, whatever that is. And that very urge gets in the way of the experience of letting all of that go. And when it goes, the very thing you were searching for is there, except the seeker. The seeker is gone. Not that you know all there is to know, but you know that you know. That there's knowing. Knowing is happening. It's all verbs. And it's an extraordinary place to arrive at. Now, having said that and made it perhaps even desirable, I don't know if it is desirable for you, but it's worth arriving at. It can't be given. There's no one who can hand it to you. No guru can give it to you. But the guru can help you begin this process of unfiltering, cutting off all of these layers of misperception. Literally, I mean, part of what I do when I sit with you is I look at you and I can, it's not a matter of seeing so much as feeling where there's a knottedness, if you will, or where there's something that's off. I can just explain it as that. Something is misguided or misrooted or something, and I don't know what leads the system into finding it, but it goes right there and it just works it. It just works it. And then suddenly there's this like a little tiny little release and it's done. And I don't know how it's done. I've never understood any of it, but I know immediately when it takes place. And I know that you will walk out of here with a part of you severed, if you will, a part of you that has defined you is no longer defining you. It could be a very ancient part. It could be a very recent construction, but whatever it is, it's gone and there is a greater flow. And that's as much as I can do. I cannot free you of yourself. I can make you frustrated that you're not there. One of my students, a wonderful, wonderful student, was so angry when I had my awakening. He was so furious that I had awakened and he hadn't, that he just sat down and tried to figure it all out. And finally he said, I'm never going to figure it out. And that moment, pop. So by getting him angry and frustrated, I served him very well. And all I can tell you is it's there to be found. Is there urgency in finding it? It's a really fascinating question. My feeling is, I don't know what to believe in terms of Buddhist cosmology. It's fascinating to me. The Tibetans have it all worked out with the wheel of life and death, and you keep coming back over and over and over again until you finally go pop. Maybe that's absolutely true. I would say it in my mind. It feels right, but it may not be. If it is true, then you may want to get off that wheel. I mean, just try to imagine high school again. Do you really want to do that? You know, do you want to go on the same ride again? Because that's kind of what they promise, that you get to do this thing over and over and over until, like Groundhog Day, you get it right. I mean, what is getting it right? It's just, oh, you see it. Ah, uh-huh. I don't have to go that way. I don't have to get caught in that trap. I don't have to, you know, whatever it is you don't have to do, you stop doing. And you finally get to a point where this whole thing just goes, done. But it takes an enormous amount of commitment. And what I feel I'm faced with, and I'm not referring directly to anyone in this room or listening to this talk, but if it registers, then listen. I call it flaky spirituality. Flaky spirituality is it's kind of like a dilettantish approach to being spiritual. You know, you do it when you want to do it. And a lot of people do it because it's an identity. Oh, I'm spiritual. You know, I eat quinoa and I don't eat meat. And whatever your thing is, you have, you become a spiritual identity, and that has zero to do with what we're talking about here. I have friends who sit when life is, meditate when life is hard, and I have friends who only sit when life is good. Winter soldier, summer soldier. They define when I'll do it, when I'll go to the gym and when I won't go to the gym. You know, look at it that way. And just the fact that you are debating, today I'll go to the gym, I feel like it, today I won't, so a week or two goes by and then you go, you know, nothing happens. You know, nothing happens. It's got to be regular and disciplined. And discipline, the difference between discipline and deciding to do something is that discipline, you don't have to decide. It's you do it. This is what I do. Spiritual development, the letting go of filters, is a practice. And if you don't do it regularly, it won't happen. And if it does happen, you know, a filter will go away for a day and then a week later it's flipped back in again. And you may even have flipped it back in yourself because it's comfortable. This is how I like to see the world. It's very weird to see the world without filters. It's very weird. I mean, I'll tell you, one of the hardest parts of the world without filters is you have nothing to defend you. You have no defenses. You are completely at mercy, is the wrong word, or maybe it's a good word. Everything affects you. Everything. You are touched by everything. You're not, in a personal sense, fighting it. You're just going, ah. There is really, more than anything, an awareness of suffering, deep suffering. And it's unbelievably sorrowful. And you walk around in a kind of state of sadness that you cannot totally get rid of. On the other hand, you also experience layers of the joy of being that are indescribable. And often at the same time, because you can't imagine that this beauty could be harmed, but it can. Everything that you love can be lost. Living in that yin-yang mix, on that razor's edge of awareness, is where you end up. You are in touch with totality. You are totality. That's really who we all are. That's all there is. But by filtering it, you're protected in some way. You don't have to touch it, feel it. You can cut it off. You can do it. I'll worry about it tomorrow. You know, you can use that approach. There's lots of ways of being that allow you to not feel the universe. When you awaken, you will feel everything. And you will be aware that there's more yet to feel. I mean, there's only so much a body can endure. But you become one with everything. And you, or let's put it this way, you realize you have always been one with everything. And that the loss of filter is the loss of the illusion that you're separate from anything. You're not and never have been. So nothing changes except your awareness that you are absolutely everything, and what you discover at the core of that everything is that there's nothing there at all. If you can handle that, and you can reach for it, and you can tell whatever you want to call it, God, the universe, the guys upstairs, that you're available to this awareness. And they listen and trust you. And they will at some point trust what you're saying. Boop, there you are. It's yours. If you are flaky about it, or kind of, you want it today but not tomorrow, believe me, they used to say somewhere, God is not mocked. You can't fool the universe. You can't say, I'm ready, and they look at you and go, yeah. Right. You know, why would they pour their wisdom into somebody who's all holes and leaks, where it just comes in and goes out? Nobody would do that. You know, they want you to be ready. And one of the great things about Rudy and his teaching was this idea of your life has to work. You have to have solidity. You have to have functionality. You have to be a person. You have to be part of this capacity to hold and do and serve, and then it supports that. If you are not that, it doesn't. It's that simple. Why would it? But each one of you, if you're sitting in this room here now, hearing this, are ready. You're completely ready. You wouldn't be here otherwise. Trust me, this is a very, very rarefied gathering. It doesn't happen all the time. And it's kind of up to you. How much do you want? How much do you want to give to it, and how much are you ready to serve it? And serving it doesn't mean containing it. It just means getting out of the way and letting it work. You know, you're not required to do anything but let go. And it will function. It will function, but it will also make huge demands on you. You know, I mean, it will make. I mean, you're meant to function, which means every human being that comes into your quadrant or into your focus, they're there for a reason. And what is that reason? To be acknowledged, if you will. To be seen, to be witnessed by you. That's all. Witnessed. But by you, not by someone who goes, oh my God, she's so fat, or she's so gorgeous, or she... It's to be witnessed as a presence. And if you witness everyone around you, like the people in the in the laundry. You know, if you witness them as a presence, and this happened to me in Seattle, it was amazing. I just loved the people in the laundry. The last place we went when we were in Seattle was out to dinner with our launderers, with the cleaners. And it was one of the best amazing dinners imaginable. We just were connected, you know? We had this with our, Blanche and I, with our trainers at the gym. You're present with these people, and they're present with you, and there's no judgment, and you've given something that will endure. It will endure. I think it will endure. If it doesn't endure, it certainly was there in the moment. That's how you live. You begin to live with the responsibility that if it's in front of you, it's yours. Whatever it may be, it's yours. It may be there for a tenth of a second. It may be there for 20 years or 50 years or whatever. If it's in front of you, it's yours. If you marry it, you better be good. You better work with it and be good to it, because that's your job. That whatever's at the core of your mandala, if you give birth to it, that's your work. If you don't have that particular kind of configuration, who arises? Best friend. Who's your best friend? They require presence and consciousness. Who are the people you see on the subway, on the street, on whatever? That's your daily work. And if you are available to that, the universe just floods you with consciousness and presence. And you can give and give and give. And what happens when you give and give and give is you become more and more and more available to source. So much more goes through you. You can't believe the richness and the depth and the fulfillment that comes in the space that you occupy. It's an extraordinary ride, and we're all on it. Everyone is on it. It's just, I'm waiting for everyone to pop to that awareness. That's all I'm here for, is to help people pop. And that's how I look at it now. And a popping means just go, oh, wow, I'm not filtered. I am that. I am this. I am, period. That's the only goal of what is being done here. And then you don't need this at all. You don't need to come here. I don't even know if you need to come here now, but the reality is, sitting in a group, a sangha like this, is an opportunity to remember that there's something that can be done here if you want it to be done. And we're all here together on that ride. So, as best we can, let's remove the filters, commit yourself to clarity, commit yourself to this ride, tell the universe, I'm available, I'm willing to do whatever, thy will be done. Make that statement, live it, prove it, and they will take you seriously. They're looking for you. Trust me, the universe is looking for you. It needs you. It needs you more than you can possibly imagine. And there aren't a lot of people stepping up. You are. It's you. It's up to you. Who else is there? How many people are sitting here listening to this right now and hearing these words and knowing, yes, you can. You can do this, and you can. I know you can. So whatever it is, even if it doesn't pop like that, live as though it did, because it's not hard. Just live consciously. Sit in that space for however many minutes a day. Feel that. Let it filter through you. It will do that. It'll give you this sense of presence that can go on for 5 minutes, an hour, a week, a month, or two. I had it for 6 months before I popped, and it's just there. And then it goes away and you think you've done something wrong. You've done nothing wrong. It comes and goes. That's what it does. It comes and it goes. Even once you've awakened, it's there when it wants to be there and not there when it doesn't want to be there. And you don't fret. You just go, okay, today's a hard day. You know? It's not a personal thing. It's not punishing. It's not your problem when there's a thunderstorm. You know, it's not about you. It's just a thunderstorm. And it goes, it comes. That's how it works. The life is like that. We're all in this on a ride. We're all on this amazing journey, but we're all not seeing what that journey is. Hopefully, this talk or someone else's talk or some book you'll read or something will let you go, I get it. Then you commit to the ride, and then the universe commits to you, and then pop. There you are to do the work. And there's no work that you have to do. It does it, really. It's not you that's doing it. It just happens. And in the most mundane lifestyles, you know, you can be working at the butcher shop, or you can be working behind the counter of something and serving the world dramatically, truly, dramatically. It's not about a high-powered anything. In fact, the high-powered guys are the last people who are going to hear this, probably, because they're the most threatened. How they might lose everything. And when you have a lot, that's scary. I will tell you, however, having a lot and then walking away from it is a great muscle system. That's a great achievement. You don't see it a lot. A lot of the people who are willing to walk away from everything, you know, don't have a pot to piss in. And so it's easy to do that, easier. But the joyful thing is whatever you have is only temporary. Enjoy it while you got it. Open to the truth of your own being. Be available. Let thy will be done. And enjoy this life and serve. You know, there's no end point to this talk, so I'm just gonna stop it. Are there any questions? I mean, does this provoke questions? I don't know if it's a kind of thing where you go, but. I mean, a lot of people have buts, usually. You know, I get it, but I have this problem, I have that, my mother-in-law, my this. It goes on. And there's all these, everyone has reasons why they can't do this, everybody. And none of them are real. They're part of your filter. But just see what we're talking about here. It's not hard. Just let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. That's the practice. That's the real practice. Surrender. Okay? Jenny?
You were talking about that fabulous meal with the laundress and people that you meet in kind of serendipitous perhaps situations. But what if you go through long periods when you're not receptive to being garrulous or that social and you're just kind of, you know, retreating within for whatever reason? Are you cheating yourself of a whole lot? Because maybe you want to go into yourself so you can produce a creative project or something.
I mean, the filter of thinking there's right and wrong in this is its own problem. It just is what it is.
Okay.
Why judge it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not trying to make my path the what your path should be, which is completely wrong. If everyone in this room now tries to have dinner with the people at the laundry, they're getting the wrong idea. You know, the idea is what do you wake up to in the day? You know, what is your truth? The problem is most of us don't know that. We don't see it clearly, and that's where we get in trouble. So all I prescribe is sit down quietly once a day or twice a day, whatever works for you, and get quiet and see what presents. And what presents will guide you. It really does. And if nothing shows up, well, then do nothing. Or just read the newspaper and go to work or whatever it is that you do until something tells you this way, that way, or you start to hurt in some way or feel bad about something. That's a signal. And you can pay attention to that signal and see where it goes. Go right into it, in fact. Don't run from it, which is the instinctive thing to do. Go toward it. And when you go toward that thing, you will see, oh, this is why I hurt. This is what I'm not doing, what I'm avoiding, what's hard for me. And you start to do that thing and it changes your life, whatever it may be. But so many of us are thinking it's one way or another way, and it's just the way. You find the way, you know, it's not the right or wrong way, just find the way. And again, look for this voice in you that goes like, it kind of goes like this. Is that available? It's a tiny, tiny little thing that just pushes you in a direction. And if you listen to that, it's an amazing thing because it will guide you. Most people go, no way. I'm not doing that. What are they talking about? You know, and they just, it's like, no, there's not a chance in hell I'm going to do that. Well, okay. And it just says to the universe, not yet. Not ready. You know, so many steps we avoid in life because we're so terrified of the outcome. But who's afraid and what is the filter that creates that fear? That's what you want to let go of. See through that filter. And often the only way to get through the filter is to go through the fear. And then the filter just, you see it almost like it's not real. It has no real substance. And that's a great release. Most filters are created, as I said, when you were a tiny kid. You know, it's a little four-year-old that's running your life right now.
Yeah.
You know, and why give it that power? It's crazy. But we do. Okay. Thank you guys for coming. Next week, Blanche and I will be in New York. The week after that, we'll have class here. classes will probably be 2 to 3 times a month, something like that. And there's no requirement that anybody come, but it's available. And you can look at it in your own terms of, again, I don't care where you go or what you do, but there's an opportunity here to get reinforced, in a sense, in a particular way of looking at life. So you're welcome to come for that reinforcement, but it's in no way going to do anything to you other than help maybe inspire a certain kind of action or way of being, and we'll all get closer and closer and to a sense of communal clarity. And that's an amazing thing, where people really do understand, wow, we, and not through an ownership position, but through a kind of lack of ownership, we are the very thing that we're looking for. Okay, thank you.